This is a reading of the early lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Christian Mystery. This is lecture 5.6, entitled The Lord's Prayer Considered Esoterically, Part 2, given on February 18, 1907, in Berlin. What I was able to say here last time demonstrates how the entire spiritual scientific view of the essential nature of the human being is actually expressed in a single well-known prayer. We were able to convince ourselves that religious currents and their doctrines and practices are drawn from what we have been able to learn over time from spiritual science itself. We must imagine this process as follows. Humankind's point of departure was a single, universal, all-encompassing, and fundamental view expressed differently in the religious confessions of various ethnic groups according to differences in their national character. Of course, you may ask how we are to imagine this more specifically. How do fundamental truths, the fundamental wisdom of humanity, relate to what the founders of religions proclaimed to one or the other ethnic group through different individual religious creeds? It is certainly striking that in the seven requests of the Lord's Prayer, we encounter fundamental spiritual scientific concepts. To someone who has had little to do with what spiritual science can teach us today, much of this must seem fantastic, and such a person can easily say that we are reading all this into what we have retained from our study of religious documents. How did the great fundamental truths find their way into individual religious confessions? In order to penetrate a bit deeper into this question, we must begin with a basic issue. We must become clear that in the most ancient times, religious views did not present what we are able to know today, what the esoteric view teaches us, as this is done now. It must be clear to us that ways of presenting such truths to people vary greatly according to the times. All the ancient religious documents that you may read speak in images rather than in concepts. As much as possible, religious documents retain these images, which are often borrowed from the sensory visualization process. Consequently, insight, for example, is always spoken of as a light, and wisdom as water, as a kind of fluid element. When you look closely, you find the same images present in the most ancient times. There is a very specific reason for this. Today we will summarize some things we already know in order to immerse ourselves in how humanity's very first teachers influenced the ethnic groups to whom they brought the benefits of religious teachings. If we want to understand the activity and influence of the founders of religions before those we have designated as the great initiates, that is, before the time of Hermes, Zarathustra, Buddha, Moses, or ultimately the greatest, Christ Jesus, we must once again contemplate the difference between ordinary human consciousness and astral or imaginative consciousness. From morning to night, ordinary human beings today possess what we have called representational consciousness, which reveals things as existing outside the human being, their attributes disclosed through the human senses. But this is not the only type of consciousness. Admittedly, as far as most people today are concerned, the other states of consciousness are hidden, submerged in the indeterminate darkness we call dreamless sleep, a state that has a very specific significance for initiates. For initiates who are also aware of the world behind this physical phenomenon, a conscious state exists also in the time between falling asleep and waking up, a state in which they do perceive a world as such, although admittedly they do not perceive the things that are here now in their same forms. For ordinary human beings, dreamless sleep is an unconscious state. For initiates, it is a conscious state in which they witness the spiritual world. If we want to understand how this unconscious state becomes conscious, we must consider another transitional state that is familiar to us, that is dream-filled sleep, which shows us the symbols of ordinary daily perceptions or inner states of soul. The figurative aspect of dreams, however, can be found only when you study the consciousness of initiates sojourning in the spiritual world. They see things in the spiritual world in images, but not in the chaotic images that a dream reveals. The only thing these images have in common with dream images is that they constantly change as well. A table or a chair always presents the same form. It is what it is. And, to the extent that they are external objects, plants, and human beings, each object presents its one form. But as we move into the realm of consciousness, more transformations take place. A plant sprouts from seed and unfolds stems, leaves, flowers, and fruit. An animal expresses its will. And a human being, we see all these in motion, in their changing gestures and physiognomy. All this is something enduring, however, compared to what is experienced in a higher state of consciousness within the world of Devakan. In that world, we see constant transformation. And those who enter the spirit world through appropriate practices learn how a plant's color arises from the plant like a flame. They learn to recognize colors as formations freely ascending and descending in space. But they see such things correctly only when they develop the capacity to perceive colors and sounds as things in themselves, and to associate them with specific beings. These kinds of beings are all around us all the time. If you are able to separate the violet color from a particular flower, so that the violet color moved freely in space, it would express the life of that plant's spiritual inner world. This is also how the human aura works, and what we call the astral body. All human inclinations and feelings of vanity and egoism are expressed there in very specific streams of color, so we can say that inner soul experience is expressed in the human aura. The aura is never still. What is there is not static as are things in the sense-perceptible world. And whenever a being in the spiritual world experiences an impulse of feeling or will, you can always see how that impulse is expressed in very specific changes in colors and sounds. Eternal movement is the essential character of the higher worlds. Of course, this is confusing for those entering the higher worlds for the first time, but it also means that everything present in those higher worlds reveals itself instantaneously. As human beings, we can conceal our soul lives from those who can observe only with physical eyes, but we cannot hide anything from those capable of seeing with spiritual eyes. In the spiritual world, everything is clearly revealed. If we want to use our physical eyes to examine a human being, our conclusions about that soul must arise from the external aspect of how that person smiles or weeps. Things are different in the higher world. Conclusions about inner aspects are not based on external aspects. Inner aspects are revealed fully, and we coexist with the essential nature of each thing. In our time, only initiates can acquire such consciousness and dwell consciously in the higher world. They are able to supplement the consciousness that prevails between waking and falling asleep with a different consciousness that allows them to add an inner aspect to the outer. Although today only initiates can consciously experience the inner aspect of things, during primeval times all human beings had this ability in a certain sense. Before we possessed our present state of consciousness, we possessed one that allowed us to see things from within. As we go back into ancient times, we find that human beings had less and less of what they possess today. People today can count and do arithmetic. In the middle of the Atlantean period, you could not find human beings still incapable, in the middle of the Atlantean period, you could find human beings still incapable of these things, and who did not possess what we call logic. In this sense, the youngest schoolchild today can do more than any Atlantean could. But the Atlanteans were capable of something else when they contemplated any natural being, a plant, for example. They could see a very specific feeling arising within them. To them, each plant had a specific emotional value. Modern people pass by plants with a kind of indifference, but vivid sensations and feelings arose in the Atlanteans. And if we go back far enough, to the time of the first Atlanteans, we would also find that their impressions of color were not as vivid as those of people today. If those Atlanteans had approached a violet, they would not have seen it as it exists now, but as though a sort of nebulous formation were arising toward them. Similarly, they would not have seen the red color of a rose resting on that rose, but would have seen a red aura around it, a red color floating freely in space. When you look at a crystal, if it is a ruby, you perceive it today as red. The first Atlanteans, however, would not have seen the color in the crystal itself. To them, the crystal would have appeared surrounded by a radiant halo of color. The ruby itself would have seemed simply as a kind of incision into that colored halo. In an even more distant past, human beings would not have perceived the outlines of other human beings at all, or those of plants or animals. Instead, when they approached another human being who was hostile toward them, they discerned a reddish-brown color. If they saw a beautiful blue color, they knew that the person was at peace with them. Each person's inner life revealed itself to them in colors such as these. If we go back still further, we come to the distant past of ancient Lemuria, between Asia, Australia, and Africa. In those times, everything was very different, not just their consciousness of knowing, but everything that could be called a will impulse. The will still had a magical effect, and had power over other objects. It revealed itself as a force of nature that affected other objects. If Lemurians held their hands over a plant and sank their will forces into it, they were able to make the plant grow quickly through pure will. External forces in nature are also found within the human being. But because the human being has become self-contained and enclosed within skin, human forces have become increasingly distant from and less similar to the forces of nature. Human thinking is least like the forces of nature. Counting and calculating are the most foreign to what exists in nature. Nonetheless, if you were able to go back far enough, you would find beings, the spiritual ancestors of humanity, for whom, compared to us, it would have been complete nonsense to say that they formed concepts of external objects. They would not have said such a thing. Rather, they would have seen the concept as an activity, or even as a being. Today, when we form a concept of anything, we must imagine the thing as originally being shaped by this same concept. You can get an idea of this by recalling the process leading to anything created by a human being. You can conceptualize a finished clock, its working mechanism and the forward movement of its hands. You could never do that, however, if you had not been preceded by a clockmaker who thought the thoughts you are now following in your own mind. You are following in thought what the clockmaker placed into the clock. All the concepts that human beings can formulate today, everything our thinking presently accomplishes, existed as a reality in the past, a reality inserted into those things. Any being is understood by way of its concept, according to which it was once formed. What was happening in the world at that past age was no different from what happens in human artistry today. The concepts people formulate today were originally placed into those things. When you go back far enough, you find human beings who never could have said that they formulate concepts by looking at things. Instead, they would have truly seen what was happening, how the concept was being inserted into the thing. They watched the artisan creating the thing, as it were. This is the difference between our modern intellect and the intellect of those times, which we might call creative intellect. But if you were to become familiar with the beings who still had first-hand knowledge of creative intellect, in contrast to today's merely receptive intellect, you would find these beings completely different from us. They were not yet incarnated into human bodies. At that time, what inhabits a physical human body today was still in the bosom of divine spiritual beings. To use a comparison, without noticing it, we have passed the point in Earth's evolution that would reveal itself to us in this way. Down on Earth, physical life already existed. There were beings who, although they were very different, resembled present-day minerals, plants, and animals. There were also beings who were not human, but were somewhere between animals and human beings, and were mature enough to receive human souls. They were organized to the extent that they could receive human souls. Comparisons are the only way of describing how this should be imagined. Human beings wandered on Earth who were still, in fact, animal humans. Now imagine these human bodies as individual sponges, and their souls as drops of water still united in a common watery mass. Imagine the earth crawling with beings and enveloped by, quote, soul substance, unquote, just as it is now enveloped by air. Within this soul substance, everything remained undifferentiated, like those drops of water. And then it was as though you had allowed the mass of water to be soaked up by the sponges, so that each one received a single drop of its own. What had formerly been unified soul substance was soaked up by the individual human bodies and distributed among them. This is how the human soul first came about. Without this process, human substance would never have split into many individualities. At this point, however, began a gradual process of human beings separating from their surroundings. Through this process, they also received a particular kind of representational consciousness. Before then, they had possessed a consciousness that did not form concepts. Rather, the human soul still existed within the soul of the cosmos and received all of its wisdom from the common cosmic soul as if from the inside out. It did not need to look outward. We might really say that the common cosmic soul could still do everything. It shaped everything that exists on earth today according to concepts held in common. Individual human beings received those concepts inasmuch as each one was given that drop of wisdom from the common cosmic soul. This is the difference between ancient knowledge, which had not yet incarnated in the flesh, and modern knowledge, which arises when human beings turn outward. Today, in the moment, human beings no longer perceive with their senses. Their inner being sinks down. Today, in the moment, human beings no longer perceive with their senses. Their inner beings sink down into the indeterminate darkness we call dreamless sleep. In sleep, the human physical body and etheric body remain lying there, while the astral body moves out. What part of the human being sees the outer world? It is the astral body that discerns colors and sounds. The astral body experiences pleasure when it enjoys something pleasurable, and the astral body also experiences pain as such. Today, however, this human astral body cannot accomplish anything unless it is inside the physical body, because it needs eyes, ears, and all the physical instruments of pleasure, suffering, pain, joy, and so forth, in order to apprehend its surroundings. The physical body is merely the instrument, of course, but it is a necessity for today's astral body. As soon as the astral body leaves the physical body, it no longer perceives. This astral body is exactly the same as the one that previously existed within the shared soul substance surrounding the earth. If you were to separate out all astral bodies and put them together, you would have the astral or soul substance that formerly surrounded human beings. If it were possible to put the entire human race to sleep, so that all the human beings now on earth were sleeping, and to lift out all their astral bodies and mingle them with the rest of soul substance, we would find that dreamless sleep would stop completely. To be sure, human souls would not perceive colors and sounds through any outer instruments, but colors would begin to rise up on all these astral bodies. Constantly changing colored images would be drifting around on all sides, and an inner resounding would begin. Once again, all this would envelop the earth, just as it did when the first incarnation of a soul had not yet taken place. The dimming of the ancient state of consciousness that you know today from your dreamless sleep came about when the cosmic soul separated the shared astral substance into individual parts, which then moved into human bodies. But you can go still further back, to a time when everything that is now night for human beings, everything that sinks down into an indeterminate darkness, was absolutely filled with light, with perceptions of the spiritual world. In short, it was day. You arrive at a stage of humanity when all human beings perceived astrally, though not within physical bodies. Ask yourselves, what has humanity in fact gained since then? What has been added to what humanity already possessed? What have human beings gained through incarnation in the flesh? We have gained the possibility of calling ourselves capital I. Previously, our entire consciousness, regardless of its degree of clairvoyance, was merely a somewhat heightened dream consciousness. Human beings were not yet aware of themselves. This is what humanity has won, the real gift from God, described in religious documents such as the Bible, that when humanity was first being embodied, humankind was given self-awareness. This was something human beings had not known previously. And among present-day humanity, this consciousness of self will continue to grow. The, quote, I am, unquote, is what has been revealing itself for as long as we have been in a state of consciousness that is no longer either dull or clairvoyant, and we can call it by no other name than, quote, I am the I am, unquote. Here you have the word of Yahweh, quote, I am, who was, is, and shall be, unquote. We have made our way back to a time when the I am word was still without life and not yet present in human beings. Human beings' consciousness had been poured into them. They had not acquired it for themselves by looking at outer objects. Where was the I am consciousness then? At that time, divine beings possessed this consciousness of self. Human beings acquired it after being physically incarnated. There you have the difference between what Christianity calls the Holy Spirit and the Spirit as such. The Holy Spirit is the Spirit above, which possessed consciousness of self before embodiment, and the Spirit as such is the Spirit that possesses I-consciousness in the human being. Thus, if you were to put all our human I-consciousness together and separate them from egoism, you would have the Holy Spirit once again. There you have our point of departure clothed in its most radical form. We have gone back in time to a very curious means of teaching. Today, teaching takes place in a meeting between person and person, in which the student is told how things are. Formerly, however, the only possible form of teaching was simultaneously work, activity. It was an outpouring of wisdom into individual beings. Wisdom did not come from outside, but instead flowed toward human beings from within, in a process that only initiates understand today. If you were to move down through the ages toward our own times, from the times I have just described, when there was no teaching, but only a process of illumining from within outward, you would encounter a transition time, when people existed half in one state of consciousness and half in the other, as it were. This was the middle of the Atlantean period. At that time, people could recognize the specific outlines of things, and were capable of seeing colors gradually settling on the surfaces of objects. They could see how individual things acquired attributes. But they saw all this only as if enveloped in a colored fog. They still heard sounds resounding through the entire world, wise sounds that spoke to them and brought them tidings of other beings. In this transitional stage, however, all this became very confused. At that time, a means of teaching also began that was gradually transformed into the later ways of imparting religious information to people. If we were able to go back to the ancient Atlantean period, we would encounter a great school of adepts. The capacity of a person today to receive wisdom was made possible by the fact that the Turanian adepts of that time had pupils who then instructed others and so on down to our own times, so that a direct tradition reaches back to the Turanian school of adepts. The adepts of that time had to take into account the fact that human beings were in a transitional stage, in which they possessed only part of our modern way of perceiving. People were capable of recognizing only indistinct outlines of objects, but they were also able to receive the truth from the inside out, at least in part. At that time, very few people would have been able to count to five, which is not possible without self-awareness, but they were able to receive what was reflected in their inner aspect, in their semi-sleeping consciousness. If they were to be presented with the highest wisdom, they had to be enlightened. But this wisdom had to be presented to them in pictorial form, and the Turanian adepts had specific methods of accomplishing this. They would not have been able to do it in a lecture, as is done today. The adepts knew all this themselves, and were much more advanced than the remainder of humanity, which was still extremely primitive. The adepts transported people into a hypnotic state, in order to present them with wisdom. This would be wrong today, but at that time it was totally normal. People were transported into a sleeping state of a sort, in which they were enlightened in a way I will describe shortly. Before the first incarnation of a human soul into a body, there was no night, and all human beings were enlightened. Dreamless sleep was the state in which human beings had perceptions. By the time of the Turanian adepts, people no longer had that ability. It had disappeared and been traded for the ability to see objects in general outlines. This increase in external perceptions was matched by a loss of inner perceptions. However, among the adepts, certain abilities had been cultivated. They had learned what we now call esoteric script and esoteric speech. You all know that there are certain mantras, certain archetypal formulas for prayer, and that their speech sounds have specific inherent effects. The first words of the Gospel, according to John, were also obtained in this way, when it says, quote, "In the beginning was the Word," unquote. There is a certain value inherent in the beginning that was originally present throughout the first words of John's Gospel. But all this is a mere shadow in comparison with the sound combining used in the school of adepts, which replaced people's lost capacity for enlightenment. In an hypnotic sleep, people were able to receive enlightenment once again from others who were initiates. That is, these pupils received a form of artificial enlightenment from their more advanced brothers. This allowed them once again to see the spirits at work in the spiritual world that had always surrounded them, just as had been possible before human souls became embodied. This was what pupils in Turanian times experienced as the first form of religious instruction. The laws of the cosmos were imparted to them. From enlightenment such as this, they received formulas and drawings. For when a certain very specific lawfulness of line was present, drawings could also convey the great secrets of the universe to human beings. At that time, if you had drawn a spiral for people, they would not have seen it when their eyes were open. But if this spiral was presented to them or tapped out while they were in a hypnotic sleep, it would have elicited very specific sensations about how a plant, for example, develops to the point of forming a seed, and how the seed becomes a new plant. Such formulas and lines were then passed on by the schools of adepts, and later given to the various ethnic groups by the founders of their religions. The further back we go, the more the soul that has been divided up among human individuals becomes a unitary soul. Being divided up and separated from each other in this way is what has made souls different. Even today, all astral bodies are still similar during sleep, but by day they look quite different. That was also how it was when astral bodies were instructed while in an hypnotic state. They were all quite similar, and a certain archetypal wisdom could be communicated to all of them. When people lost the ability to receive wisdom in this way, teaching in India then had to accord with the requirements of the Indian body, in Persia according to the Persian body, and again differently in Greece and Egypt and among the Germanic peoples. This was what external physical bodies required, according to the various influences exerted upon them. The founders of religions cast this in the forms that have come down to us today as the Egyptian teachings of Hermes, the teachings of Zarathustra, and so forth. In true religions, in all their fundamental forms, however, what brought them into being is alive. How people formerly received enlightenment is totally different from how this can happen today. It was not communication through teaching, but communication through living. This is a much more intimate encounter between pupils and their teacher. You can get an idea of it from the example of the spiral that stimulated direct sensations. Today we communicate concepts and sensations. Today we communicate concepts, and sensations can be kindled only by way of these concepts. One such concept that was communicated in the Turanian school of adepts was the sevenfold nature of the human being. This is still present today, concealed as thoughts in the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is the expression of sevenfold human nature. This was made clear to the pupils of the Turanian adepts by presenting them with a musical scale, mingled with certain images of color and a scale of odors, as a symbol of the seven members of the human being. What was inherent in the harmony of the sevenfold scale rose up in these pupils as an inner experience. What existed outwardly served only as a means to this end. The great founders of religions cast this in certain formulas. The greatest of them imparted it in the Lord's Prayer, and its action and effect are available to anyone who says this prayer. As such, the Lord's Prayer is a prayer that is not a mantra. It will still be meaningful when thousands and thousands of years have passed, because it is a thought mantra. The action and effect of the Lord's Prayer were cast in thoughts. And just as it is true that human beings can digest food quite well without first being told by a physiologist about the action and effect of the digestive process, those who pray using the Lord's Prayer can sense its effect without being told about it. The effect of the Lord's Prayer is present because it exists within the power of the thoughts themselves. Nevertheless, there is a higher knowledge that gives the Lord's Prayer a deeper meaning, and we must not shut ourselves off from this knowledge. This is the nature of the path that religious truths have taken. The souls inhabiting our bodies today once dwelled within the shared divine substance of the Spirit and were enlightened there in a sleep-like state. Without eye awareness, they were able to perceive the creative activity of spiritual divine forces. Then these souls were incorporated into bodies, and this perception was increasingly obscured from them. They even lost the possibility of bringing about this state artificially, as it had still been possible in the Turanian school of adepts. Religious doctrines and formulas are only echoes of the sensations that could once be communicated from person to person, and that were drawn from the primal wisdom that created the world itself. It is as if the wisdom of the Old Testament were spoken by primal ideas, by the primal wisdom that underlies all things. Your souls once possessed this wisdom. In the future, human beings will draw from within their own souls what they originally possessed in the dull, dreamlike consciousness, but they will do so in the clear, bright consciousness of day. We will possess our present clarity of consciousness and enlightenment as well. To achieve self-awareness, human beings had to give up their original clairvoyance, and the more this original clairvoyance was subdued, the brighter the light of inner eye consciousness became. Once this has reached its peak in our final incarnation, what we will carry with us as the fruit of our life will be both the old clairvoyance and a newly acquired element. Again and again we hear the cliché that human beings must gradually merge into a universal consciousness. This is what redemption is said to be, losing our present-day consciousness and merging into a universal one. However, this is not the way things really are. Eye consciousness, which formerly was not present at all, will persist even beyond our final incarnation. What once separated out from the shared substance of the Spirit will flow together once again, but now you must imagine it in this way. Originally there was clear water that was soaked up by the many, many little sponges. In the course of separation, however, this water takes up whatever it can from its surroundings, and each little drop assumes a very specific color. When the water is squeezed out of the sponges again, each one contributes its own color. So a great variety of colors is present, shimmering and more beautiful than it could ever have been before. In the same way, individuals returning to the universal spiritual element contribute the particular colors of their consciousness as individuals, which cannot be lost. Universal consciousness will be a harmony of all forms of consciousness. Beings who have passed through the stage of humanity will freely constitute a unity. While remaining many entities, they will also form a unity, but because they choose to do so rather than because they are forced. Each one has retained individual consciousness, and of their own will they all form a unified consciousness together. This is how we must imagine the beginning and the end of our current world process. Instead of using clichés, we must observe how things really are. All talk of, quote, merging into a universal consciousness, unquote, is a pantheistic cliché. But when we are speaking from the perspective of eternity, the saying that we must keep in mind shows us that humanity did not exist for nothing, that it had a significance for the universe. In other words, those who take up the study of cosmic facts will ultimately realize that human beings have been called to take part in giving meaning to this life of ours. Ultimately, we will each have to offer up on the altar of the divinity the little bit that we ourselves have won. From these bits, as has been expressed so beautifully, the spirit of the earth as a whole will weave the fabric for its garment. Goethe spoke as a true initiate when he depicted this as an actual process, quote, "In floods of life, in storms of deeds, I ebb and flow, weave to and fro, birth and grave, eternal sea, weave changingly, live glowingly. Thus on the humming loom of time I work to make the living garment of the divine." End quote. The divinity will wear its immortal garment when the earth has achieved perfection. On their upward path through individual incarnations, by going through birth and death, individual human beings will weave the fabric of this garment. The end of Lecture 5.6.